Once again, as we did during the mid-morning break, any comments, any questions, anything interesting that came up during lunch that you want to raise, the floor is open. It's not going to be a final Q&A, so this is as close to final Q&A as you're going to get. Any comments? Okay, did anybody work on Dirty Moms? What? You just got your lunch, huh? was there any Dirty Mom work? Okay, that's all right. I'm okay with that too. I think it is worth noticing that, you know, I mean, I framed the crisis of the Dirty Mom in the way that most crises happen. The natural history of the crisis is pre-crisis, you're doing precaution advocacy, mid-crisis, you're doing crisis communication, and post-crisis, you're doing outrage management. You know, certainly in the months before this pandemic, and in the years before this pandemic, starting, you know, in 1997 when bird flu showed up in Hong Kong, for some of us starting much later than that in 2007 when bird flu started to preoccupy a whole lot more people, we were all doing precaution advocacy. There's going to be a pandemic someday, and now's our time to prepare, and let's get our act together, and let's think about getting ready. And then, the crisis we're in now is a much smaller crisis than we thought it would be when we were thinking about bird flu. But we are in mid-crisis now. We are no longer mostly warning people. We are now mostly guiding people who are concerned and want to know how best to behave. And post-crisis, inevitably, even this little baby crisis, post-crisis, we will be doing outrage management. In some ways, that's the definition of when the crisis is over. In the middle of a crisis, people sort of postpone the recriminations because they're counting on you to save their life. And when they're no longer worried about you saving their life, then they have a chance to get mad at you for having screwed it up. And that's actually good news. It means the crisis is over. Yes, comment?
When I think of the scenario that you presented, I think of the attempted bombings of the London to U.S. air flight 2 years ago, 3 years ago, where they actually waited until people got on the plane with the chemicals before they did something and apprehended them. And I think messaging and along the lines of why didn't you tell us would be similar to that message, and that, you know, being able, you know, if you thwart it, you're just postponing it. But if you're able to catch them right handed, then you're eliminating it.
Yes.
That was the thought that I
did. Yeah, and of course, you know, the outrage is much smaller when you're successful in catching the bad guys. When the bad guys are successful in exploding the bomb, then after the crisis is over, the question of why on earth you kept a secret and didn't tell us about it is a big, big, big deal. You all understand you can't win, right? If you prepare for a crisis and it happens, the outrage when it's over will be, why didn't you prepare better? And why didn't you manage it better? If you prepare for crisis and it doesn't happen, the outrage afterwards will be, why did you overprepare? How dare you waste all this money and effort and resources on a pandemic when there wasn't one? We still don't know which kind of outrage we're going to face with this sort of baby pandemic that we're in now. When this pandemic is over, obviously, if it gets more severe, the outrage is going to be, my God, you had all the warning in the world and you still weren't ready. If it doesn't get more severe, and if it supplants the seasonal flu and actually saves lives, there may be very considerable outrage when the pandemic is over about why were you busy overselling the pandemic. Not to mention, of course, that if there are any problems surface, real or imaginary, with the vaccine, it will not take much to replicate 1976 with a vaccine that at least looks to people more severe than the pandemic is designed to address.
couple people at lunch were nice enough to tell me that they liked it when I interrupted Peter. So
I was not one of them.
This is a shtick. I just want to say, this is a prolonged episode, so the idea that the outrage will mostly come at the end, it's not quite like that in an ongoing situation. It's more like a marathon than a sprint. So there's lots of pockets of outrage along the way with this pandemic, as you all know. Very local outrage, national outrage, lots of congressional demands for testimony that I think are a huge waste of time for these people that really should be back at CDC, but I'm not sure it's part of the political reality. But there's lots of waves of outrage during a prolonged, slow motion crisis. And then at the end, it's a whole different level of outrage.
I think that's accurate. Therefore, it was a good interruption. Other comments? Okay. If you look at your handouts, skip the first page, and starting with the second page of the handouts is Crisis Communication 1, How Bad Is It? How Sure Are You? Followed by Crisis Communication 2, Coping with the Emotional Side of the Crisis, followed by 3, Involving the Public, followed by 4, Errors, Misimpressions, and Half-Truths, a total of 25 crisis communication recommendations. We have an hour and 5 minutes left, of which I need 5 minutes for closing remarks, so we have an hour left. It took me an hour and a quarter to cover 4 outrage management recommendations, and I didn't cover them thoroughly. So I'm not going to get through these 25, but I'm going to talk somewhat more abbreviated about these than I did about outrage management and get through as many of them as I can.
What page are you on?
I'm on page 37. And I will cover more than I did of, more than 4 of these 25, but my goal is to get to maybe 13 or so. Get half done, and I may or may not make that goal in the next hour. But the first of the 25 recommendations is don't over-reassure. Now, the reason don't over-reassure is on the list and don't over-alarm isn't on the list is because nobody ever over-alarms in a crisis, whereas over-reassuring is extremely common. Over-alarming is also a mistake, but it's a rare mistake. And these 25 recommendations focus on the common mistakes. Now, what happens? Why is over-reassuring a mistake? What happens when you over-reassure people and then the situation goes to hell? You lose your credibility. And why is that a big deal? What happens when you lose your credibility? Yeah, I mean, that certainly is, reputation is a whole lot easier to lose than it is to regain. But it's gone. But so what? That's only your credibility. Why is that a big deal?
Well, because you're only getting to do the things that you're asking
to protect yourself. That's right. Your credibility is crucial in a crisis. Your credibility is essential in order to save lives. You need people to evacuate if you tell them to evacuate, to line up for vaccines if you want them to line up for vaccines, to stay home for 2 weeks if you need them to stay home for 2 weeks. You're going to ask people to do difficult things. You need them to trust you. If you piss away that trust at the very beginning of a crisis, that's a bigger, much bigger problem than losing credibility in normal times. Because, in normal times, your credibility is your problem. In a crisis, your credibility is a health problem. Is a safety problem. But that's not the biggest reason for not over-reassuring. The biggest reason for not over-reassuring is the seesaw. What am I talking about?
Public aware of the other one.
That's right. When you over-reassure in real time, before things get bad, most people get more upset, not less upset. They smell a rat. Things haven't gotten bad yet, but they sense that you're being more reassuring than the facts justify. That happened in Three Mile Island. Most people's recollection, people who live, were alive and sentient and following the media in 1979, remember the Three Mile Island coverage as alarming. It wasn't alarming. You know, the Kennedy Commission on which I serve, the staff of which I serve, did a content analysis of the media coverage of Three Mile Island. It was overwhelmingly reassuring. There were many more paragraphs of reassuring content than of alarming content. Nonetheless, our recollection that the media coverage was alarming is accurate because we found that reassuring content alarming. It's very hard to think of a paragraph that is more alarming than "everything is under control, sweetheart, don't worry your pretty little head about it." That's a very alarming paragraph, not to mention infuriating. And a lot of the media coverage at Three Mile Island was like that. By the way, I should point out, those of you who are used to media being sensationalist, media are sensationalist in good times. In crises, media join with officials in over-reassuring. From Three Mile Island to SARS, to swine flu, are there endless examples. You know, when the hazard is high and the outrage is also high, the coverage will stop being sensational. It'll be extensive, but it'll stop being sensational and it becomes reassuring. But it doesn't reassure. It becomes reassuring and it scares people. One of my favorite examples of that was after 9/11. Christy Todd Whitman, you will remember, was then EPA administrator, and after 9/11, a week after 9/11, she announced, and I'll quote her directly, "I am glad to reassure the people of New York and Washington, D.C. that their air is safe to breathe." Now, that sentence is pretty famous because there was an EPA investigative general report on the administration's efforts to reassure the public after 9/11. And it was very well documented that when Administrator Whitman said that the air in New York and Washington, D.C. is safe to breathe, that's pretty much true in Washington, D.C., and she didn't know whether it was true or not in New York. I mean, you can't say she was lying. She didn't have enough information to lie or to tell the truth. She was basically making up the data. But what's interesting to me is you know, the authorities were doing overnight polling in New York City in the days after 9/11. So we have nightly data on how upset people were. And how upset people were spiked after Christy Todd Whitman said the air is safe to breathe. People, they didn't have any more data than she had, but they had a good ship detector, and they sensed that she was over reassuring them, and they became more alarmed. Okay. So the biggest reason for not over reassuring people is not that they'll find you out later, it's that they'll smell you out in real time, and that over reassurance will in fact have an alarming effect.
A question back here.
Yes, sorry.
You seem to suggest, or maybe I read you wrong yesterday, but when you did the Barrett lecture, you seem, the way I read it, you seem to suggest that maybe everyone was over-reassuring in terms of the flu vaccine being safe. Were you suggesting that slightly? Because I worry about that. I mean, if we do have that first adverse reaction, which we probably will somewhere, sometime, then what have we done? And it's a tricky slope, because if we don't, there's already so much fear that the vaccine's rushed and all that kind of thing, and it's new, and that we don't get people to take shots. And
yeah, it's going to undermine the MMR, it's going to undermine polio, it's going to undermine everything. I do think you are over-reassuring about vaccine safety, by which I don't mean that I think vaccines are dangerous enough that any wise person would take it. I mean, I think it makes more sense to get vaccinated against H1N1 if you're in the high-priority groups than not to get vaccinated. Enormously more sense. I think the risk of the vaccine is orders of magnitude smaller than the risk of the disease. I also think the risk of the vaccine is higher than you are giving the impression you think it is. And by that definition, you are over-reassured. Yes, you heard me right.
Okay.
Yeah. You're 98% right claiming to be 100% right, or sounding like you're claiming to be 100% right. I have a 2% is going to kill you.
So what do we do? Exactly, everybody's saying this. You know, it's safe, it's made the same way that we make flu vaccine, that we've been making flu vaccine for decades. I mean, we're all singing in the same choir.
Yeah, well, I mean, in an optimum world, you know, in my judgment, instead of saying the vaccine is safe, full stop, I would say, look, you know, all medications have side effects. All vaccines are medications. This vaccine is new. And, you know, new medications don't have necessarily more side effects than old, but they have less well-established side effects. So if you're asking, is this vaccine, you know, more dangerous than baseline? In principle, the answer is yes, slightly. If you're asking, is this vaccine more dangerous than going naked in a pandemic? The answer is no by a long shot. So the uncomfortable choice we all face is whether to take a slightly dangerous vaccine or not to take a slightly dangerous vaccine to protect us against a pandemic that is more dangerous than some of us are realizing. And I would much rather see you do stronger precaution advocacy on the pandemic than excessively over-reassuring, excessively overconfident outrage management on the vaccine. So, I think the strongest case to be made for getting vaccinated is the case that's to be made for all medication. It's better than the disease. It's your best shot. Okay. But doctors who say the medication is without risk are always making a mistake, and vaccination proponents who say or seem to say, because you don't actually say it's without risk, you give the impression that that's what you say.
Yeah.
And that impression will come back to haunt you, and then you'll want to say, we never claimed it was risk-free. You know, and, you know, having 30 years of experience with corporations that later on want to say, we never claimed it was impossible there'd be an explosion. You know, we never claimed our emissions can't give you cancer. It is our flaw. The time to come out of the closet that it's better than the disease, it's safer than the disease, but it is not risk-free, is beforehand, not afterwards. And you're almost at it.
I know, I was going to say it was too late.
No, you're only almost too late. You're going to have to explicitly back up. You know, you can't say one thing for a while and then start saying the other and have it make sense unless you explicitly say, we've been giving, you know, we've done some surveys and we find that we've given the impression that we think the vaccine is risk-free. And that does you a disservice. It's not what we think, and it's our mistake for giving you that impression. We need to back up and explain that the vaccine has real risks, some of which we know, and some of which we don't know, because it's a new vaccine. What we're sure of is it's a better gamble than going naked in a pandemic. You know, I don't think it's too late, but it's too late to just change messages. You're going to have to be explicit about the fact that you're changing messages. We're going to turn this hour into a Q&A, and that's all right, as long as it's what you want.
I'm sorry, I'm in the middle of developing some ads on this topic, so I want to just see how I'm hearing you. So what do you think about the word safe when used with this vaccine? I mean, does something have to be risk-free to be considered safe, I guess?
If you use the word safe without an adverb, and without a modifier, and without a number, you are claiming it to be zero risk. That, you know, you're dichotomizing risk at zero if you're dichotomizing safe versus unsafe. The right answer to is X safe is always no. And then, pretty much whatever X is, the right answer is X safe is no. And then you stop in a conversation, you know, in a PSA, you don't stop. In a conversation, you stop, and there'll be a pause, and then people will say, well, what do you mean? And you get to say, well, what most people mean by safe is zero risk. And, you know, no, the vaccine's not zero risk. You know, the factory is not zero risk. The emissions are not, whatever you're talking about. And then you stop again, and people say, well, I didn't mean zero risk. Okay. What I meant is it safe enough that I ought to take it? And then you say, well, I sure as hell think so. You know, I mean, it's hundreds of times safer than the disease. And now you're you know, you have been forced to address the right question. Okay? That if you can't have that dialogue, then you have to frame the right question yourself. And you have to say, the question isn't, is it safe? Of course it's not safe, if safe means zero risk. There are risks associated with everything we do. And the vaccine is no exception. And we're sorry we gave the impression that we think, or that we want you to think, it's zero risk, but that's nonsense. Okay. What we want you to think is it's a better gamble, not even close, a lot better gamble than going unvaccinated. And you can do that.
Well, we've been saying things like, you know, this vaccine is the best way to protect yourself from swine flu, and I don't think we're saying that it's 100% safe by saying that, but I'm just
struggling. I'm okay with the best way to protect yourself, but the problem is, if people already think you're claiming 100% safe, and their shit detector is going ding, 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 then you have to go beyond not saying that. You have to say that you're not saying that. And, you know, it's your intuition or your research that will tell you whether that's the case. Yes, Joe?
The second item on this crisis communication list sort of speaks to that, or maybe it's number three. You can say, even though it's the best way to protect yourself from swine flu, that doesn't mean we're saying it's completely safe. We've given that impression. You've let us know that we've given that impression. So you can combine the two messages with a nice even though. Even though, good news, nevertheless, not perfect.
Now, and since Jody introduced even though, it is number three, but let me do it now, and then I'll come back to number two. Number three is to put the reassuring information in a subordinate clause. If you don't know what a subordinate clause is, don't worry about it. It won't be on the test. But your problem is you want to reassure people, but you don't want them to get the feeling that you're over-reassuring them and experience that boomerang effect, that seesaw effect that over-reassurance produces. And the way you do that is by crafting a message, the main thrust of which is this is something worth worrying about. And the subordinate thrust is information that helps people realize that it's not such a big problem, it's maybe not worth worrying about. What you're doing is giving them the ammunition with which to think that you are overemphasizing, the ammunition with which to think that you are overemphasizing the risk. You understand what I'm saying? In crisis communication, the way you reassure people is by sounding to them like you're a little bit more alarmist than they need to be. Okay? Do you hear the seesaw in what I just said? So here's Julie Gerberding. She learned this during anthrax and used it during SARS. Here's Julie Gerberding talking about SARS. One of the issues in SARS was whether SARS might be terrorism. It was right after, or just a couple of years after 9/11, and people were concerned, could this be terrorism? And here's Julie Gerberding on whether SARS could be terrorism. While we have lots of reasons to think that the SARS outbreaks are not due to terrorism, we're keeping an open mind and being vigilant. Okay. Do you hear the structure of that sentence? Even though, or while we have reasons to be reassured, we're worried anyway. Another issue was community transmission of SARS. You know, once you've got your community transmission, then normal epidemiological methods may not do the job. You're in Pandemicville. So there were lots of questions about community transmission. And here's Dr. Gerberding again. Although we haven't seen community transmission of SARS, we're not out of the woods yet. Same structure. Even though we have reasons to be not so worried, we're worried anyway. Some of you will have seen both Tom Frieden and before him, what's his name?
Besser,
that's who I was trying to think of. Richard Besser, using this, saying, you know, could the pandemic get more severe? Even though it has been very stable so far, we're really worried about a possible increase in severity. And the effect of that is to simultaneously give people the warning and give them the feeling that you're a little alarmist, and they want you a little alarmist. So it doesn't, they don't experience it as over reassurance. Gerberding got so good at this that at one point there was an issue of a very slow news day of whether stars might be from outer space. And Miriam Falco of CNN at one of the news conferences said, "Dr. G, I just have to ask you about this outer space thing. What do you think?" Dr. Gerberding answered, and again this is a direct quote, "Although we have no evidence that SARS is from outer space, we're keeping an open mind." Same structure, and reporters laughed too, you know, but they got it, that, you know, I mean, they began to understand that CDC, as Julie Gerberding learned, that CDC was not going to take an over reassuring stance. It was going to embed any reassuring information in a sentence, the main thrust of which was a warning. And that, you know, you can take that to the bank as a way to reassure people without getting the seesaw effect that says you're over reassuring. Number three is to err on the alarming side. If you can get it exactly right, you should. But you can't get it exactly right. In a crisis, you know, you're not going to be able to get it exactly right. So the question is, you know, if you're going to get it wrong, which way is more harmful? Being more reassuring than the truth turns out to be, or being more alarming than the truth turns out to be? They both do harm, but alarm, over-alarm, does a lot less harm and a lot briefer harm than over-reassurance. So, you know, what I routinely say to clients is, in any crisis, you want your early statements to be alarming enough that you are virtually certain you will not have to come back and say it's worse than you thought. That means you will probably have to come back and say it's not as bad as we feared. And you'll take heat for that. You know, people will criticize you for having been alarmist, and, you know, you just live with that criticism because it's enormously preferable to criticism for having been over-reassuring. Given that you can't get it exactly right, you err on the alarming side. There's a spectacular example of that from Singapore. I can give you a radiation example, even better. I'll skip Singapore. Three Mile Island, one of the things the health department was worried about was iodine 131, radioactive iodine, which they feared would be one of the pollutants coming out of the stack. Iodine 131 would tend to settle into, this was an agricultural area, it would settle into the grass, cows would eat the grass, iodine 131 would be in local milk, kids would drink the milk, iodine 131 bio concentrates in the thyroid, where it represents a very serious risk of thyroid cancer. Very early in the accident, the Commissioner of Health of Pennsylvania, anybody here from the Health Department of Pennsylvania? Oh, that's too bad. Commissioner of Health of Pennsylvania, held a news conference, issued a statement, and he said, "Look, we're worried that there's likely to be iodine 131 in the milk. Don't drink local milk." He had no data. Okay. And the dairy industry attacked him. How dare you, you know, worry about iodine 131 in milk when you don't have any evidence that there is any? And he said, "Look, I'd, you know, much rather worry early than have people getting iodine 131 doses in their daily milk supply." 2 days later, he had done the first round of testing, not found any iodine 131, issued a second release in which he said, "We didn't find any iodine 131 in the milk yet. That's not really surprising. It's probably working its way through the digestive system of the cows. Don't drink local milk." 2 days later, third news release, "We still haven't found any iodine 131 in the milk. We're beginning to think maybe there isn't, but, you know, we want to do another round of testing. You know, don't drink local milk." 2 days later, fourth release, "Still no iodine 131 in the milk. We're now pretty sure there probably isn't any iodine 131, but we're going to bring in extra sensitive testing equipment and do one last round of testing. Don't drink local milk." 2 days later, this is now the fifth news release, we have now determined to our satisfaction that there is no iodine 131 in the milk. Go ahead and drink local milk. We apologize to the dairy industry for, you know, having cost them, you know, 10 days of sales. And sales of local milk rebounded 100%. In contrast to that, if the Pennsylvania Health Department had done what Christy Todd Whitman did after 9/11 and had said on day one, we are glad to assure the people of central Pennsylvania that there is no iodine-131 in local milk, they still wouldn't be drinking local milk 30 years later in central Pennsylvania. And as you know, there are still very active concerns on the part of New Yorkers who live or work even as much as a couple of miles from the World Trade Center, that they might have gotten a lethal dose of God knows what. And then, you know, I mean, that's outrage fueled beyond a shadow of a doubt, and the outrage is fueled largely by over-reassurance, whereas in New York, I'm sorry, at Three Mile Island, instead of over-reassuring, the health department was excessively alarmist. They let the public watch them convince themselves that the milk was safe to drink. And by the time the health department was convinced that the milk was safe to drink, the people of central Pennsylvania were already convinced that the milk was safe to drink, and they were waiting for the health department to put its stamp of approval on it. That's ideal. The health department, the dairy industry didn't understand that. The dairy industry thought the health department was screwing them. It was actually saving them. But because they didn't understand crisis communication or risk communication, they simply didn't get it. You should expect the same thing. Erring on the alarming side is the right thing to do. Persuading the governor, persuading the affected industry, you know, whether it's the meat industry and you're talking about BSE, or it's the tourism industry and you're talking about SARS, or it's the poultry industry and you're talking about bird flu, or the pork industry and you're talking about swine flu, whoever it is. If you err on the alarming side, you can expect political leaders and industry leaders to be angry at you and to try to change what you do. And if they win, they will screw themselves. Because erring on the alarming side is not only what's best for public health, it's also what's best for the survival of these industries, for minimizing the negative impact of the crisis. Any questions about number three? Okay. Number four, and this now changes from the, you know, one, two, and three were all about alarm versus reassurance. And you see that alarm versus reassurance is a seesaw. We're now going to a different seesaw. Number four is to acknowledge uncertainty. Okay. And this is a different seesaw. And as I hope you've come to understand with regard to seesaws, what this one means is the more confident you sound in situations where confidence is not justified, the more unconfident we get. We are ambivalent about whether you know what you're doing or not. We are ambivalent about whether this situation is well understood or poorly understood. And when you say it is well understood and you know what you're doing, we get more nervous that you probably don't know what you're doing. This is one I'm very familiar with as a consultant, because I long since figured out that when I say to clients, don't worry about it, I'm one of the world's leading experts in the field, trust me, they get very anxious. And when I say to clients, look, you know, it's not like this is rocket science. A lot of this is just, you know, guesswork and intuition and reasoning from examples. And yeah, I've got some theory, but it doesn't come with a guarantee. It's not like physics. And ultimately, you're going to have to decide for yourself whether you think I'm guessing better than people who are giving you contrary advice. When I say that, they do more of what I recommend. So you see the seesaw of alarm versus reassurance operating. And I think it operates very routinely in a crisis. Is it possible to overdo tentativeness? Is it possible to sound too unconfident? Absolutely. But it's not likely to be your problem. I mean, it's certainly true that if you come across as really not knowing what you're doing and as going nuts and out of your depth and unable to cope, people will get anxious. They don't want leaders who can't cope. So paradoxically enough, what you want to do is claim uncertainty in a confident tone. Confidently claim that you're not confident. And what you're communicating is, yeah, there's a lot of uncertainty here, but that is your day job. You're used to dealing with uncertainty, and it's not freaking you out. And if it's not freaking you out, it won't freak us out. Does everybody see the ways in which this is relevant to the pandemic? I mean, you know, we don't know where it's going. And you need to spend a lot of time emphasizing that you don't know where it's going and that you need to be nimble and that all your policies are very tentative. But you need to say those things confidently so we think that you're, you know, you're able to cope with that situation. David Heyman, who managed SARS for the World Health Organization, had a nice phrase for this, and you're welcome to steal it, because he wasn't the first to use it either. He said, "We are sailing our boat, and, I'm sorry, we are building our boat and sailing it at the same time." You're building our boat and sailing it at the same time. You all hear that that's a very elegant way of saying we're making it up as we go along. If he had literally said, "We're making it up as we go along," senior management of WHO might have had a problem. But "We are building our boat and sailing it at the same time" had a nice elegant feel to it, and he got away with that. And the public got it. People who heard that quote heard it as, you know, we're making it up. We're not sure what we're doing. We're going to have to change some things. Jeff Copeland, during the anthrax crisis, and many things were handled badly during the anthrax crisis, but Copeland was then head of the CDC, and he said one thing that was just spectacularly good, learned this quote too because it's beautiful. He said, and this was like on day one or day two of the anthrax crisis, he said, "We will learn things in the coming weeks that we will then wish we had known when we started." You can embroider that on a sampler and hang it behind your desk for crisis communication. "We will learn things in the coming weeks that we will then wish we had known when we started." What does that mean? What's the money payoff of "we will learn things in the coming weeks that we will then wish we had known when we started"? Hindsight is 20/20. And what does it mean about foresight? We're going to make mistakes. We're going to do things, and 2 weeks later, we're going to say, "Oh, shit, we wish we hadn't done that." You know, because we'll have learned things, and we'll wish we'd known them when we started. You'll notice that people doing risk communication that is eternally difficult tend to dress it up in literary form so that it slides through easier. I would rather he said, "Inevitably, we will make mistakes." But this one got through the White House better. And you guys all have White Houses to get through. You all have politicians to get through. And dressing it up and making it sound a little bit more literary helps it survive. And that's not too high a price to pay.